All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this, the 20th day of August, 2019. Before I talk about today's show, let me remind you, I do publish a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, and you can subscribe to that letter, which I think you should do because it's an exciting time in the junior gold mining space. Go to miningstocks.com, and sign up for the letter, or you can call us here in New York at 718-457-1426, 718-457-1426. Also like to encourage you to consider subscribing to Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? Go to chenpicks.com. Also, I want to thank you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular Voice America business channel shows. And I do want to invite you to continue sending along your comments to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions4taylor@gmail.com. Also want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. Sponsors for today's show, Klondike Gold, Novo Resources, Radisson Mining Resources, and Great Bear Resources. I've titled today's show, Frank Holmes on Gold and Markets in General. Forced by the U.S. to abandon the gold-backed monetary system after August 15, 1971, the world has embarked 100% on the use of fantasy money created out of thin air rather than money with intrinsic value. The dollar, which is dictated by law, not chosen by markets, is money backed not by assets like gold or silver, but money that is manufactured by debt and hence has no intrinsic value. When Nixon separated the dollar from gold and ushered in a floating rate global monetary system backed by debt, the dollar retained its value not because it had any intrinsic value, but because the U.S. used its military superiority to essentially force the world to accept the dollar for commerce, most notably underpinned by an agreement with the Saudis to require all global oil purchases made in dollars. That's how the U.S. dollar became the world's reserve currency, which meant we in the U.S. didn't have to produce much of anything to buy production from developing nations. We could simply print money to get what we wanted, and so we did. Now it seems other countries are not so sure they want to continue using dollars for their trade or to invest in a country that uses the proceeds of treasury bonds to expand its military and force those same nations to submit to Anglo-American empire desires. Not only that, but with so much money printed over the decades, it has served to destroy capitalism by denying price discovery of capital. And so the U.S. uses its resources to wage war everywhere while a cancer within the global market system spreads, leading to what many believe will be a global contraction of wealth in the years to come. One thing we do know is that unlike fiat money, gold retains its purchasing power, as James Turk pointed out so well in last week's show. One investment pro who knows as much as about the gold markets as anyone I know is Frank Holmes, the CEO Chief Investment Officer of U.S. Global Funds. Frank will be with me in the second half of today's hour to give an outlook on gold and other markets during this, during the second part of today's show. And he'll also talk about the gold ETF that is under the U.S. Global Funds umbrella. It is a fund that is really outperforming its peers. So we want to find out from Frank how he has managed to accomplish that. Right after our first commercial break, Eric Coffin, the co-founder of the Metals Investor Forum and author of an excellent newsletter called The Hard Rock Analyst, will be with me to give his views on the markets, and he will talk about a couple of the stocks he is most excited about as this new bull market really starts to get underway. Eric always has great insights into the markets in general as well, and one of his favorites, however, among the gold stocks is Great Bear Resources, a company that is a sponsor of this show. It's also one of my favorites, so I'm really looking forward to what Eric has to say about Great Bear. But right now, I'm happy to tell you that I have Michael Oliver with us to help us see where things are going and find out what's on his mind today. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Always good to have you with me. Now, you know, we have clearly seen gold in a very convincing breakout mode over the past couple of months. What, in your view, is driving gold, and to what heights do you think it might go as measured in U.S. dollars?
Well, gee, that last question. I don't know. Taking out the all-time highs is 2011 highs, likely. Right now, this particular surge that we're in, I think, is likely to reach 1700 area. There might be some congestion in between, minor correction, but I don't see anything of a major correction, which so many people are looking for constantly over the last few months. I'm sure they're frustrated. Every time they get a dip, it stops about 2 days later and goes back up. But as far as the ultimate, I don't know. I can't technically determine that except to say that I do think we're in the final drama of market manipulation and the things you've just defined. In other words, the errors in calculation that so many people have made because of the distortions of the underlying money unit, but because of distortions in the cost of money, you know, and so forth, and over such a long period of time now, 10 years solid of this stuff. So the distortions that are millions, you know, individuals make mistakes, corporations make mistakes, governments, et cetera. So many mistakes have been piled up based on these false metrics that it's hard to tell all the ramifications except to know that they're large. Yeah. We've never had such a thing. So when it unleashes to then say, well, where's gold going to go in that process? I can say up and big,
yeah,
but I can't tell, you know, what is a number that we're headed for. I can't tell.
Yeah, of course, understandably. And, of course, we don't really know with the dollar not having any value, or certainly not any consistent value, then, you know, that's the unknown as well. It's like changing the length of a yardstick and then asking what is a yard.
Yep.
But, Michael, you know, one of the things that I'm hearing from a lot of my friends, people that have been watching markets for a while, you know, they all seem to be kind of fearful that we're heading into, that we'll have another kind of 2008, 2009, and then a deflationary collapse of commodities and just a deflationary environment in general. But actually, you seem to be holding out the view that we could be looking at something more akin to the late 1970s up to 1980. And sort of do I understand, maybe you think we could be headed for a deflationary sort of a situation like the 70s where we had both a lot of inflation and a lot of unemployment?
Right. It's what they call the word stagflation came about.
Stagflation, right. Thank you.
It was actually a depression, but we'll get away from that. Anyway, so the stock market was a wasteland for a decade. Put money in the stock market, was up and down and up and down, but didn't go anywhere for 10 years. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, in the mid to late 70s, commodities, which had already been trashed, were laying at levels that were based to what we call theoretical zero. And it was, commodities don't go to zero. Company stocks can go to zero.
Mm-hmm.
But commodities can't. And there's certain times in history where they get bashed so bad, so low, that they demonstrate that, one, I'm not going any lower. Okay, and I think that's basically where commodities are now. In 2011 and early 2012, MSA turned major bearish on gold, emerging markets, and commodities in general, CRB index, or the Bloomberg Commodity Indexes, which is the one we watch now. The Bloomberg Commodity Index back then in 2011 had a peak above 170. We got bearish in the low 140s in December of 2011. They collapsed to a low in 2016, coincident with gold's drop, of 72. So they were cut in half from the 2011 high to the 2016 low. Then the Bloomberg Commodity Index rallied from the low 70s up into the low 90s, a 27% rally. In 2018 was its rally high. And now, since then, it's rolled back over, and it's about 77 right now. It's still off of its 2016 low. But when you look at a price chart of Bloomberg, it's 3.5 years, almost 4 years now, of sideways.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going down. It collapsed. I mean, what do you want? It go to zero? It's not going to go to zero.
Uh-huh.
Same
uh-huh.
if you look at a chart of corn, wheat, soybeans, sugar. They made lows. They had rallies to varying extents, and then they flop back down. But they're not making new lows. They're in a range. So the definition of what they're in technically is sideways, horizontal
mm-hmm.
markets. They're not bear. They're not bull. We did have some good strong moves out of oil and copper during that period. They both peaked in 2018 after very strong percent moves and then flopped back down hard. But we think that the commodity complex as a whole, we've made some fumbles on calling the grains, for example. They've had some up moves and they were false. When they fell back, they didn't go to new lows. They just went sideways again.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a concert, the commodity complex will move in unison. But I think that's likely to occur when the stock market does get whacked hard, because at that point, first off, there's some technical linkage right now between the Bloomberg Commodity Index and, let's say, the S&P. It's hard to detect, but, you know, as the S&P weakened recently, so did the Bloomberg, et cetera, and oil drops with the stock market, rallies with the
mm-hmm.
stock market. But we think a separation is going to occur, and we think it started in the form of stock market peaking and commodities bottoming.
Mm-hmm.
When the central banks go nutso on the
mm-hmm.
next stock market drop, and they will definitely go nutso,
mm-hmm.
they've already said so, I think that money is going to flow into the commodity complex simply because it ain't going down anymore. And people
mm-hmm.
will perceive that, though. You know, rational minds will look at the charts and say, these aren't bear markets, these are sideways.
Yeah. Well,
they don't want to go any lower.
Well, Michael, let me ask you this then. You've been a short-term bull on the Treasury markets, the T-bond you watch closely. You've been, as I understand it, a long-term bear on those same markets. Do you think then that the turn downward in the Treasury markets might occur along with the realization that we are in an inflationary environment?
I suspect that the T-bond downturn, I mean, a rise in yields, and I don't
mm-hmm.
think the drop in yields right now is over with. It has nothing to do with
yeah.
it. It has to do with market forces.
I
think they're going to continue to drop in yield as the market tops and goes down, stock market.
Mm-hmm.
I think once you get your first big whoosh down in the stock market, at that point you're likely to get a spike up, flight to quality, flight to safety, in the T-bonds. At that
mm-hmm.
point, I'd get very suspicious about continued drop in rates, continued rise in the T-bond market in price, because
mm-hmm.
I think at that point some emotion will come into the T-bonds that is more or less flushed out the money that it's going to get from those who are fleeing the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, that's where I'm looking for the T-bonds to probably crest and head back down in price, meaning rise in yields. And that's when you get your real nightmare. You have a weak stock market, and then you have rising rates as well.
Yeah.
I think during that period of time, we're likely to have the commodity boom like we had in the late 1970s,
mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, was led about by a year, the gold market.
Yeah. Right, right.
And so I think that's where we are.
All right.
And,
all right, very good. I would just mention, you said, I think when you first started talking about the 70s, it was a depression. And I know James Dines talked about how if you really factored in the inflation rate during the 1970s, the equity market actually performed as badly or close to as badly as it did in the 1930s in the Great Depression. So I thought that was really interesting. You can have rising prices, but if your currency is losing value all the time, those rising prices don't do you much good. Michael, thank you so much for being with us. Your views are very much appreciated, your thoughtful views. Whether people want to hear it or not, I'm thankful to you for telling it like it is or as you see it and as your very objective models suggest it is. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank
All right, folks. Well, we do have to go to break, but don't go away. Eric Coffin is going to be with me. He's the author of the Hard Rock Analyst Newsletter, an excellent newsletter that I subscribe to and enjoy very much and profit from. So I hope you'll be back right after the break with Eric Coffin.
No Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me once again Eric Coffin. Eric is the editor of the HRA, that stands for Hard Rock Analyst, a family of publications. He is also the co-founder of the Metals Investor Forum, which, by the way, will be gathering in September, on September 6th and 7th in Vancouver. It's a free-of-charge event, but you do need to sign up in order to ensure space there because the space is limited and very often I think they always sell out eventually, and so. But you need to be sure that your name is there. Just go to Jay Taylor Media, Jay Taylor Media. Click on the mining stocks, or go Jay Taylor Media or mining stocks, I should say, and click on the Metals Investor Forum banner. And all you need to do is enter your name and an email address, and then you're assured a spot at this forum. Which, by the way, has been very profitable for me in the sense that I have learned to know some excellent companies there and have invested in them, and they've done very well. So, but getting back to Eric, he always provides his views on the market. I think I always try to, as busy as we are at these conferences, try to listen in to his views on the markets in general. And there's nobody that I know among the newsletter crowd that does a better job with exploration companies, helping his subscribers understand the geology and the probabilities of success with the exploration story. So I'm really pleased to have Eric back with me again. Thanks for joining me, Eric.
Thanks for inviting me, Jay. I'm always happy to come on.
Oh, I'm well, the one that we're going to have you on more often, I think, because it's always a blessing to have you. We have clearly seen gold. I mean, this is really a convincing move. I see. I chart the monthly average gold price a day. You know, take the daily prices from the PM fix. And going back decades, and I mean, this is clearly a very distinct breakout. This looks like something that's real, very exciting. What are your thoughts about the gold market and what's driving it?
Yeah, I don't think there's much doubt this is real. I mean, I sent out something a couple of months ago to subscribers that, you know, the headline was basically, it's on. I don't think anybody can learn. Anybody that looks at charts, even at a passing interest, you can look at a gold chart and not see an obvious breakout. And this doesn't look anything, and it's not behaving anything like the upward moves that we've had four or five times in the last 3 years, you know, all of which topped out well below the level we're trading at now. This is definitely the real thing. We've got a very different market backdrop worldwide. A lot of the large economic blocks are decelerating quite rapidly. We're, you know, I think we're up to 16 or 17 trillion now in negative yielding bonds, and that's not even negative real yields, that's negative nominal yields. I honestly have trouble getting my head around the idea. It's just, to me, it's so insane, but you know, here we are. And even in the U.S., if you look at the 10-year, I think we're down to, I think we're below 1.6% on the 10-year. We've got an inverted yield curve, which is terrible for timing, but it's one of the most reliable recession, you know, forward recession indicators. I don't think it's guaranteed we have a recession, but although early this year I said I thought we'd get one in the U.S. by year end, and we're in a background where policymakers, politicians, large companies, they don't have to make many mistakes to screw this up, and I think everybody's sensing that, and that's driving the gold prices, which has been strong against everything, even against the U.S. dollar. I mean, this is the real deal this time.
Yeah, it sure seems like it. Trying to get your head around negative rates, it certainly is hard to do. It doesn't seem to make any kind of economic sense. And they're going to pay me to take out a mortgage, I guess.
Historically, if you look at really over very, very long periods of time, and you try to pick out what environment is good for the gold price, and I'm not really a gold bug per se, but if you look at it over the very long term, I think the one thing that will jump out at you as being the most positive environment for gold prices and normally for commodities in general is essentially negative in real interest rates. Mm-hmm. And the fact we've got negative, not only real but nominal ones, it's kind of the best environment you can have for gold. And the fact that it hasn't yet been a strong environment for, say, base metals is part of the reason why I'm a little edgy about the economy. When I see that divergence, that tells me that, you know, things are slowing down in a lot of places to drive that sort of divergence. So I've been kind of sticking to precious metals the last little while.
Right. Certainly is true. And copper, for example, Dr. Copper isn't cooperating with the inflationary viewpoint. Go ahead.
No, yeah, it's not acting like you'd expect copper to act if the world, because, I mean, you tend to focus on the U.S., but of course it's not. The U.S. isn't a big demand area for base metals. You know, it's China, it's Europe, and when you just, you know, you see copper trading the way it is, it doesn't make you very comfortable at the world economy.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm old enough, a little older than you, Eric, but I remember quite well the 1970s, the late 70s, the inflationary 70s, which, by the way, Michael Oliver, who was just with us, suggests he believes we're heading back towards. And that was not a good economy either. We had a lot of stagflation, and we had a lot of unemployment, and yet all of the commodity prices went up. Well, it's not that they gained value, but it's the currency was losing its value. So we measure everything in the dollar, and the dollar loses its value vis-a-vis other currencies or vis-a-vis the things that you need and have to have. It certainly was a part of the 1970s, and all of Michael's work suggests that that's where he thinks we're headed. And he noted that gold led the general commodity complex by about a year at that time, I think he said. So anyway, whatever it is, it seems that... go ahead.
I hope he's right, because I own a lot of base metal stocks, too. I don't just own gold stocks.
Well, I do kind of hope he's right, too, for the same reasons, Eric. But at the same time, I realize there could be an awful lot of suffering around the world if things go the way gold bugs think they might go. And, you know, I confess to being a gold bug, not because I want to see the world go to hell, but just basically because I think the monetary policies of the Keynesian monetary policies over decades have just been ill-advised and are leading now, I think, to some real significant problems. You know, every cycle, the lower lows for interest rates, they can't hike them back up to where they were because the debt has become so much greater. Anyway, enough of that. I want to get on to some of the things that you're really excited about and you're working on. One of them I know that we share in common, our interest, and that is a sponsor of this show, Great Bear Resources, and GBR in Canada, GTBDF in the U.S. I think, Eric, 40.7 million shares is all they have outstanding, and I see it Canadian $5.30 earlier today. It's a market cap of around 216 million, which is higher than most of the companies that I follow, but this is a really exciting story, and their initial discovery at Dixie Lake in Ontario was really considered to be very much like sort of a traditional Red Lake, or like the Red Lake mine, the famous one that was the company maker for Goldcorp. And so that was the Dixie Hinge, Dixie Limb, those initial discoveries. But now they've come up with another type of mineralization. And maybe just talk to us, what are your thoughts about this company and where it might be able to go
with this discovery? Management team, they've done a fantastic job of keeping the share structure tight while still being able to raise a lot of money. They've got $20 million in the bank now and $8 or $10 million in the money warrants that'll come in. They're very efficient and not particularly expensive drillers, so with that amount of money, they can probably literally drill a couple hundred thousand meters. Red Lake's one of those areas where you often have to drill a couple hundred thousand meters.
Yeah.
What's really interesting, what's going on now, they announced at the start of this month that they'd moved all three of the drill rigs that they have going to what they call the LP fault. And LP stands for lithoprobe. I won't bore your audience with the details, but this was a government-sponsored survey done about 30 years ago looking for very deep-seated crustal structures. Mm-hmm. As it happens, there's two of them in the Red Lake camp. One of them is the main structure that is essentially the Red Lake mine trend that's had, I don't know, 30, 35 million ounces mined off of it. The other one happens to be running right through the middle of the Dixie Project. It hasn't actually seen a lot of historic work, but they went back and looked at some of the drill holes and realized those didn't really hit what they would have assumed was the target near the fault. They drilled a couple of holes. They reported good results, but more importantly, I think for them, was two things. One, this is not Red Lake model. It's different from the other stuff in the camp. I hesitate to use this word, but the best analog I can see is probably Hemlo, actually, which is a word people your age and mine will remember very well.
Yes,
Ontario,
yes, indeed.
Very famous discovery that it kind of made the VSE, really. But when they announced at the start of this month that they've moved all three drill rigs to the LP fault, I mean, obviously they decided we got something here we've got to figure out, and these are really smart technical guys. And then last week they announced they're going to do a webinar a couple of days before MIF, actually.
Yes.
What that tells me is that they want to do a technical webinar to lay out what they're, and there's not much doubt in my mind, LP is what the webinar is going to be about. This, if they do have something that's a true analog, and I don't think they know yet, I don't think they have a lot of assays, notwithstanding having three drill rigs going. Those are all going to be hitting their office in the next 2 weeks. But if they have a true analog, one of the things about Hemlo that made it so exciting was that once they tagged onto the zone back in 1981, they were able to build ounces very fast. And if Great Bear's onto something like that, look out. Like, things are pretty crazy already if you look at the stock chart for this company, but they could definitely get crazier if they're onto something like that. But, you know, presumably we're all going to know in a couple of weeks when they have this webinar, because I'm assuming there'll be a news release ahead of it.
Okay.
That's normally how they do it. They'll put out news, and then the webinar will explain this is what we think it means. So
okay.
I think that could be, it's a big deal already, but I think it could be a much bigger deal before it's over.
All right, and the ounces could pile up quickly, I guess, because what you've got broader structures and not as narrow as I think a lot of the traditional things.
Hemlo was, they're still, as usual with these things, they're still arguing over what Hemlo even is, but
yeah.
I think the most recent version I've seen is that they called it a remobilized epithermal system, which is it was a big deformation zone, alteration zone that kind of squeezed this and stretched it out. And you ended up with these, you know, it had some really impressive thick high-grade zones, but it also had fairly broad zones. That's part of the reason why the ounces added up fast. Because Red Lake, you get an incredible high-grade there, but quite often you're dealing with 1, 2, 3-meter veins. And they're great veins, don't get me wrong, but it takes a lot of drill holes. If they've got something where they've got high-grade within 30 or 40 or 50 meters of alteration zone that's also carrying gold, I mean, the ounces will just add up a lot faster. Plus, it's close to surface. I mean, the intercepts they've noted already they've only drilled like 100-150-meter holes. This is not deep stuff.
Right. Oh, yeah, and if they have something big, they can start to see a lot of ounces there, then that will give them time to go back to the other traditional Red Lake stuff, I guess.
Oh, yeah, I don't think anybody should think this means anything, you know, bad for the other zones. The other zones are fine. They're getting, you know, expected results. Those are building ounces. I think they're just looking at this zone and saying, if this is what we think it is, we need to get on this because we need to be building ounces. Because I think they're looking over their shoulders. I think they're getting a little worried someone's going to come after them, which if they were just drilling straight up Red Lake stuff, I'd say, nah, it's too early. Nobody's going to come after them for a takeover. But if they're onto something where the ounces will build fast, that could change
That could change dramatically. Yeah, well, let's hope the share price for those of us that own the stock takes a hefty rise if that's the case. But with only 40.7 million shares, wow, this thing is very doable, very, very tempting, I would think, to some of the bigger guys. In any event, Eric, we only got a couple of minutes left, and there's another one you want to talk about, Minera Alamos.
I think this is a good stock for a rising gold price. This is a very good technical team. It's the opposite end of the spectrum when it comes to share flow.
Yeah.
They've got about 400 million shares out. But I'm okay with that because they're not in exploration mode anymore, really. I mean, they're drilling right now. They might get some good results. But what they're doing is building a couple of very low-cost mines in Mexico. Normally, with an exploration company, I would run the other way when they said that. But in this case, the guys running it, Doug, and especially Darren Koenigan. Darren is more a mining engineer. He's built three or four mines in Sonora, all of them very, very low-cost, very successful mines. Their expectation is they can put their first mine, Santana, in production for about $10 million. They've got all the permits. They have a relationship with a company called the Cisco Royalties. I'm expecting to see some kind of a news release about, you know, here's a royalty stream sale, whatever, that's going to cover the capex for Santana. Once that's up and running, which won't take long, it's a fairly simple heap leach operation, they'll shift over to their second project probably next year once the first one's going. That one's already permitted. It's a mill, but they've already bought the mill. It's also relatively low capex. I think these guys can be a 100,000-ounce producer in, like, 2 years. So I think it's a really nice, relative, you know, as safe as anything gets in this sector, sort of holding for a rising gold price, because I think it's got a lot of upside ahead of it as they grow themselves to be a producer. And they're ready to go. They've got the permits. They're good to go.
Right. Yeah, so it's only about, as you say, close to 400 million shares. 376 is what I count. I'm sure fully diluted over 400 perhaps, but 14 to 15 cents Canadian, market cap around 55 million. MAI is a symbol in Canada, MAIFF in the U.S. Yeah, so they have a couple of other projects too, don't they? They have La Fortuna.
Yeah.
Is that the one you're talking about? They might move over there after the first
Fortuna,
one.
Fortuna would be the second line, and the third one, they've optioned to another company, but that company's doing development work on it. And I know that Doug Ramshaw and Darren Koenigan, I know they're looking at a bunch of other projects. I mean, they kind of got their hands full as it is. But Darren's a guy that built a couple of the early heap leach operations, like El Castillo. I remember back in the day, Dave, when I looked at El Castillo, and it made sense, but the capex was so low, we just kind of rolled our eyes and went like, there's no way we're listing that cheap, man. Sure enough, he built it cheaper and faster, and it made a lot of money. So when he came back this time and showed me this, if it was most other guys and they said, I'm building a heap leach for $10 million, I would have just laughed, but
sure,
I've seen this guy do this.
Yeah. All right. Well, plenty of more things to hear from Eric at the Metals Investor Forum and the other newsletter writers. I'll be there as well. Gwen Preston, John Kaiser, a number of us will be there. Go to J. Taylor Media, click on the Metals Investor Forum banner, and enter your name and an email address, and you'll have access to this forum. And you need to do that because they do sell it out every time. So be sure you sign up if you're in the Vancouver area to go there. The numbers are coming along pretty good, are they, Eric?
Yeah, I was just going to say the list is actually filling up fairly fast. So I imagine, as usual, we'll be closing the RSVP list before the event like we normally do.
Normally do. Okay, folks. Well, that's all the time. Thank you so much, Eric, for being with us. I should mention it's HRAAdvisory.com, HRAAdvisory.com, to check up, sign up for Eric's newsletter and learn more about what he does. Thanks, Eric, for being with us. Well, folks, we do have to go to break now. You bet. Anytime. All right. Frank Holmes will be with us right after the commercial break. He's the CEO and Chief Investment Officer, of the U.S. Global Funds. And we want to talk to him about his gold ETF, which is doing quite well these days and actually better than many of the peers. So we'll be right back with Frank Holmes. Don't go away.
Rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on their wholly owned Dixie Project in the prolific Red Lake Mining District of Canada. Having recently made four major gold discoveries, GBR is now fully funded to drill 90,000 meters through to the year 2020 as part of a very active exploration program. Rob McEwen of McEwen Mining, a Red Lake veteran, is a significant shareholder following a recent $5.7 million investment. To stay up to date, visit greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have Frank Holmes with me once again. Frank is the CEO and Chief Investment Officer of U.S. Global Funds, at the group of funds that specializes in natural resources and emerging markets. He is well known for his expertise in precious metals in that sector, as well as his general overall strong investment track record. And I should say before we say hello to Frank, the website is usfunds.com, usfunds.com. Thanks for joining me, Frank.
It's great to be with you again, Jay. And we have a better gold market.
Oh, yes, it is a happier time for us gold bugs, but it's happier in one way, but in some other ways, a lot of times gold does very well when a lot of other people aren't doing so well. So I don't cheer for higher gold prices, because other people are suffering, if that's the case. But in any event, Frank, I'd like to, you have a holistic approach to investing. You like gold very much. I know you're specialized in precious metals, but you have a very balanced approach to investing as well, better than yours truly has. I'd like to ask you to talk just briefly about your group of mutual funds and just let our listeners know about the kind of investments that your mutual funds are engaged in. Then I also want you to talk about a couple of your ETFs as well.
Great. Thank you for the opportunity to share what we do. U.S. Global was the first no-load gold fund in America mm-hmm. in the 70s, and its success was because South Africa was paying massive dividends, or like 20% dividend yields.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of the genesis of it. And then in 1990, I moved from Canada down to Texas, so I became a Texcan. Y'all come back. Hey. And with that, I tried to revamp and we embraced big money market funds at the time. So we had the ability to go between the gold funds and go to U.S. government bonds. That was sort of a big run. So interest rates went to zero. And then we repositioned so that holistic approach, Jay, is that we have a very stable tax-free fund called NEREX. It's short-term and it stays around $2 a share. And it pays monthly dividends, and that was always sort of the core position that you have, and then because it's tax free, and you have the gold funds, and then we have big blue chip funds, and we also have a short term government bond fund. But that's the sort of the holistic approach. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we noticed with gold, and what happened in the 90s was the buyers of gold, the growth was out of Asia. Mm-hmm. And so I went over to Asia on a tour and saw that when 1991 Communist China was, back then the airport was so, Beijing was so terrible when you think about what it is today. But you could go to a shopping mall and, there'd be gold traders at the back. So gold was a part of their culture, and I saw how fast China was growing, so I started a China fund. And then I saw Eastern Europe and the wall came down, so I started the first Eastern European fund. Mm-hmm. And that gave me sort of the whole global picture. And what's really interesting in the past couple of years, some of the biggest buyers has not been Germany and not been Italy or France. It's been Eastern European bloc countries, which have become big buyers of bullion of their central banks. So it's been, an interesting turn that I could see the world turn going from Asia to America to Eastern Europe and then come right around the earth.
Yeah, the countries where they've had communist rule or where they've had difficult times, they've seen how governments can screw up the economies so badly, and they're with their currencies, of course. And so I guess maybe that's the reason those areas have been so bullish on gold. Probably the Chinese, certainly, as soon as they were allowed to own gold, they started buying it like crazy, right?
Absolutely. And there's a really strong data points on Bloomberg that shows the rising GDP per capita and that they just buy more gold. So they gift giving, and I call it the love trade, and 60% of all gold demand is for love. And so I think that's a steady backdrop for what we're seeing now. And then we have the fear trade, and these fear trades can last from a year to 3 years, and I think we're in a 3-year run here, where we're going to negative real interest rates. Especially out of Europe that's driving that, and Japan. And you have something that's unprecedented. The Federal Reserve cannot buy the S&P 500 index ETF. But in Switzerland and in countries like Japan, they own 15% of the stock market. They print funny money, and they're out buying the stock market. They've not been buying gold. Whereas Poland and Hungary, as for a classic example, they've been big buyers of bullion.
Yeah. What do you think you think our Federal Reserve might do something like that, like a Swiss bank, to start buying equities?
They'd have to be a change in the federal charter. That would be a big political move. I don't think that's going to happen. But what's important on that love trade, I like to tell people, is that Indian women wear six times the amount of gold that's in Fort Knox. And some people don't believe the gold's in Fort Knox, but Indian women, I always can see the gold. That 24-karat gold is gorgeous. So I think from that end, in my global travels, I was just recently in Europe, and I just couldn't believe, Jay, how expensive it is. I mean, it really is. And the other positive part, though, is dominated by Chinese tourists. All the 3-star and 4-star hotels were sold out, so the 5-star were outrageous prices. Like the gold show they always have for the Denver Gold Show, they always have one in Zurich. Well, the Hyatt was wanting $2,400 a night for a room.
Oof. Well,
because all the other rooms were taken up by Chinese tourists. I went to Milan. That's the same thing. I saw Chinese tourism, so that fits in well with my Jets ETF because. That was a call that the rise of GDP per capita, not only do you see more gold being consumed out of China and India, but Chinese that love capitalism, the first place they go to when they get to New York City is the New York Stock Exchange. They all have selfies. You can see them. It's amazing. And we had a couple of weeks ago is in New York City for a quick trip, and it was with the New York Stock Exchange to celebrate 2 years of GoAU, launching up the Smart Beta. And so that's my sort of refreshing moment of seeing all the Chinese tourists in front of the New York Stock Exchange. It's very positive.
So I want to ask you about Jets and GoAU, but also just a question about Hong Kong in light of the difficulties that are going on there now, and your Asia fund, your China region fund. What are your thoughts about Hong Kong and what might that portend? How do you think that'll play out?
Well, the first big part is it's had a bigger impact on luxury goods and discretionary sector of the economy. and Cartier and Richemont, mm-hmm. et cetera, they're expressing their concerns. But I think that it'll resolve itself. I think that we have just a unique leadership, you know, both over there and here. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's the first president I've ever known that gets in front of the mirror every morning and checks how his hair is, and then he checks on the stock market. You know, there's no other president that uses the stock market as a barometer of future growth and economic activity than President Trump.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's really a unique pattern, and that whenever you've had an expanding economy, which we still are expanding in the U.S., and you have interest rates drop, there's 100% probability stocks will be up in 6 months.
Right. Yeah, so, that's statistically,
so, yeah. Yeah, it's a good batting average. I like that. That's like a three-point shot, but you're only a foot from the rim. You know, it's a good data point. But I think that, I'm more bullish and constructive. August is always a treacherous month. That just goes back in history.
Yeah, statistically,
so
yeah.
We've got to get over with. There's always something goes on. I remember when in 2002-03 was bad hurricanes. It was always so disruptive for the energy market. And so there's always something that happens in this time of the year. But I remain really bullish about gold, and I'm just trying to, you know, to explain to people that you're not seeing the fund flows in Europe going into the bullion ETFs. You are seeing it here, and you're not seeing it in Southeast Asia. So that I find really interesting. So it's really bullish for me that gold's going to trade higher. And I think that the juniors, the microcap stocks, they still haven't found a big bid. And so there's so many great values out there at this stage that there's probably more regulatory rules have made it more difficult for people to speculate in that space. And that's really what exploration companies are, speculation.
Oh, yes.
Someone's going to find something. And that's speculative money. But from a regulatory point of view, you're allowed to buy lottery tickets, and they never come back after that ticket expires. And you can go to a racetrack, and after that ponies run around the track, you're never going to get your money back. At least penny stocks, they can always come back if they've gone down. They get restructured, or something happens in the cycle. But you can go to casinos. And the speculative money, and then the other thing is I've noticed the speculative money went into the crypto space. About $5 billion in 2017 went there. So to me, trying to eliminate speculative money is like prohibition. It was a disaster.
Yeah.
And people always speculate. And hopefully they wake up to that there's a shortage of public companies. You've got to speculate for the juniors, like the cable companies today. Were one time penny stocks out of Denver. That's how they started, Jones Cable.
Yeah.
Ten-cent financings.
Yeah.
So these are the sort of things I've observed in my global travels. Europe's extremely overvalued. I don't think they're trying to manipulate the currency. I think it's just outrageous that they wiped out $1 trillion. They forgave $1 trillion of bad loans, just like forgiving student loans, like here.
Yeah.
Okay, $1 trillion, forget about them. And they print that funny bunny, and the Bank of International Settlements is complicit with all that. They'd rather take money from Venezuela's central bank, a corrupt economy, or Argentina, than they would turn around to do a cryptocurrency or gold. You know, so that's something I really discovered when I was over there that made it even more so. And for your gold listeners, what's interesting, for the past 20 years, Morgan Stanley's just come with a nice piece of research that the best performing asset class have been REITs. But number two is bullion.
Interesting. And, over the last, how many years?
20 years.
Last 20 years.
So, and the biggest hedge fund in the world, Ray Dalio's Bridgewater, he's 6 to 10% long bullion. And he does a parity trade against his other asset classes and trades them, goes on and out of the market on a regular basis. And so when you think of that, here's the number one largest, most successful big hedge fund that's always got a 10% exposure to gold, and gold's the second best asset class. So
very,
I think that, and I met Ray Dalio in early 80s at the Contrarian Opinion Forum, with Ian McAvity, our old good friend.
Oh, sure.
Who's no longer, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I was a young kid as an analyst, and he took me on a trip down to Montreal, and we drove down through the beautiful mountains there and in Vermont. And so I remember, you know, what a brilliant guy he was at this day at that time and what he is today.
Yeah,
but this
for sure.
This thesis on gold is real, and let's talk about it. You know, yeah. CPI is in the U.S. is about 1.8.
Yeah.
And the U.S. government is trying to induce you or seduce you to buy 10-year government bonds at 1.55. So
yeah.
That means you're going to lose 25 basis points over 10 years in your money.
Yeah, before you pay taxes.
And they say, okay, well, let's go 2 years. Well, that's 1.5. So I'm still going to lose money over 2 years. And most currencies move off that two-year note. And today, President Trump is pushing for 100 basis points drop in rates.
Yeah.
Well, that would mean that you would be, you know, getting, that would propel gold to 2,000. That was the last time we had a 300 basis points negative rate of return was in 2011, and gold hit 1,900. So I think this is a different scenario, but this race to zero interest rates is very, very much steeped in the psychology by so many governments to accept. The other thing is the daily volatility. It's just to really appreciate that the daily volatility of bullion is plus or minus 1%, 70% of the time, and so is the S&P 500. So, in fact, bullion is not more volatile than the stock market, as a lot of these talking heads on CNBC always say. But what's interesting is that gold stocks are more volatile, and they're more like biotechnology. It's not a benefit on a daily basis to go plus or minus 3%.
Oh, for sure.
And so it's important for investors to recognize that the volatility of the gold stocks does correlate 94% of the time in the direction of bullion, and gold stocks have more volatility to them. And so when we get these corrections of 100 basis points sell-off in bullion, it's usually a great time to buy gold stocks when you have a trend like what we're witnessing, that is, rates going to continue to fall, the world is worried about a slowing economy, and there's all these structural imbalances, that more than 25% of the global debt of governments is offering negative real rates of return. That's just a real positive scenario for the fear trade for gold.
Yeah, it's hard to see anything more positive than that. I have to ask you, Frank, you know, gold, the safe haven, so when we have risk-off days, we see the treasuries getting stronger, yields going down, and gold usually, too, has been behaving very well. When do you think that might change? When do you think that treasuries might no longer be seen? I mean, when you get to zero interest, who wants to buy those things? Well, I mean, why would you want to buy them now, as you just pointed out? But do you see a point in time, and I can remember in the late 70s, I can remember when, you know, when treasuries weren't the place to be. Interest rates were rising like crazy. Inflation was really picking up. Our first guest today, Michael Oliver, he believes that we're headed for something akin to the late 1970s. Do you see anything like that as a possibility?
Well, you had, you know, rates rising in the 70s, but they were always massively negative. They were minus 7%.
That's right.
They were never rising fast enough to catch up with inflation.
Well, so until Paul Volcker in 1980, Frank, and that's what put an end to it. But up until then, G. William Miller and those, I think before him, before Volcker, who was Arthur Burns, those guys were just pouring fuel onto the fire constantly, weren't they? Just like they're doing now.
They
just
were.
Like all the central banks are doing now.
Absolutely. The best-selling book is, you know, just print the money. And monetary policies, you can keep up with regulations, but it's just not so. And it catches up with us, and I believe that we're in that scenario now. So what's the best way to play it? Well, it's gold stocks. And the reason for that is that whenever you have an expanding economy, as I mentioned earlier, and you have rates dropping, mathematically, the odds are stocks are going to be up. Now, in all my research, my halcyon days of 2002 to 2007, when my fund, gold funds, ripped up, you know, the competition, we were number one by a wide margin for 1, 3, and 5 years, we had a strong stock market, and gold was rising. So whenever you have a strong stock market and gold is rising, the gold stocks are just spectacular performers.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've certainly seen it. And Frank, with just 2 minutes left here, talk to us a little bit about GOAU. What makes it unique, and how have you performed relative to your peers?
Well, when we did the back testing, I spent 8,000 hours on it trying to identify there's new buyers in town. The new buyers are quant funds, and quant funds are looking at different factors than the old narrative from Bay Street on NAVs and book values, etc. It's a new world. So I was able to, after 8,000 hours of research, identify those factors, and so I created AU, and it's basically 28 stocks. The problem with the GDX and GDXJ is that when money goes into them, money equally goes into shitty stocks, excuse my French, rotten stocks or bad stocks, as good stocks. So you get diluted, and all I said, I'm going to screen them. So there's 88 global gold producers. I'm going to automatically take 44 of them, and I'm going to look at those with the lowest debt-to-equity ratio. And then I'm going to look for those companies that are showing revenue last quarter is above four quarters and cash flow last quarter is above four quarters and have free cash flow yields. And then go right down to mine down to $200 million market caps. And our study showed that this would outperform the GDXJ more than 90% of the time on rolling 12-month periods going back a decade. So after all that research, I launched it 2 years ago. And Jay, I'm happy to tell your listeners, and we talked about it on your show when we just launched it, it's outperformed the GDXJ by 16% in two years. And I believe year-to-date, the last time I looked at it, it was beating it by 10%.
Wonderful.
So I think it's an intelligent way that if you own the GDX and GXJ, you have the same fee structure, but you have intelligent stock picking by U.S. Global for New York Stock Exchange. Go gold, go AU.
And so you, just with 30 seconds left, Frank, so you can change those the composition of those 28 stocks from time to time. Is that right?
That's a very good question. 30% are royalty companies, Jay, because you know the superior, superior business model. So they rebalance each quarter, but the other names change every quarter. So it's actively changing every quarter. And the biggest opportunity took place this time last year when Vanguard blew out of the gold stocks right at the bottom. And we had great stocks being sold out, and we bought them. And that was the biggest turnover. Otherwise, turnover has been pretty slow, and these stocks have done what they've done. You know, they've outperformed all the active gold fund managers and other ETFs.
Okay, we'll have to leave it go at that. Frank, thank you so much for being with us today. Folks, it's usfunds.com, usfunds.com. Go there, learn more about all that Frank and his team are doing there. A very good story. Well, that's it for today, folks. Next week, my main guest is going to be Alistair McLeod, and I think we're going to have probably Michael Oliver with us and a surprise guest as well. So until next week, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.